From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, we're joined by country blues singer and guitarist Roy Bookbinder. He'll sing some songs, tell the stories behind them, and we'll talk about his life on the road. Also today, I speak with alto saxophonist Frank Morgan. His career was cut short in the 50s by his heroin habit, which resulted in 30 years in and out of prison. Morgan is back on the jazz scene, getting rave reviews. Our rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album from the go-go group Trouble Funk, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Big Easy, the cop story set in a steamy New Orleans, starring Dennis Quaid and Ellen Barkin. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. The Philadelphia Folk Festival, one of the largest and longest-running folk festivals in the country, is about to begin. One of the featured performers is with us here today, blues singer and guitarist Roy Bookbinder. He's brought his guitar and he's going to perform some songs for us. Roy Bookbinder plays southern blues and hillbilly music. At the beginning of his career, he sought out the Reverend Gary Davis, who taught him his guitar style. They toured together for a couple of years. Bookbinder also went to the South to track down one of his favorite performers, Pink Anderson, who had played in medicine shows for over 40 years. And before Anderson died, he taught Bookbinder many of his songs. Bookbinder recorded a few albums on the Blue Goose and Flying Fish record labels, and he plans to record in Nashville this fall. Bookbinder tours continually, living out of his Airstream motorhome. In addition to performing at festivals and state fairs, he's become a regular guest on the Nashville Network's cable TV show Nashville Now. Roy Bookbinder, welcome to Fresh Air. And before we talk, can you get us started with a song?
Sure can. Call me a dog when I'm gone. It's old black dog when I'm gone. But when I get home with a $10 bill, it's daddy, where you been so long? Well, I've been all around Kentucky in the state of old Tennessee. Call me a dog when I'm gone, Lord, Lord. Old black dog when I'm gone. When I get home with a $10 bill, is daddy where you been so long? My daddy was a gambling man from the state of old Tennessee. He taught me to bet all of my money on ace, jack, that deuce, and a tray. Go pick it, Roy. Train, it's coming, carrying my baby away. It's going all far to leave me, ain't never coming back my way. And it's old black dog when I'm gone, Lord, Lord. It's old black dog when I'm gone. But when I get home with a $10 bill, daddy, where you been so long? Black Dog Blues.
Performed by my guest, Roy Bookbinder. You know, I know that you've been singing blues and country blues for many years, and once you were billed in a club as yet another white blues singer, what do you think of that kind of attitude that somehow it's not authentic for people from the North or for white people to be singing southern-based blues?
Well, I think it's totally wrong, because there's a tradition of, quote, white blues singers throughout the history of country music and blues music.
That song I just did, the Black Dog Blues, was originally recorded by a bunch of fellas, a black and white. It was recorded by Bayless Rose, who was a black guitar player and singer, and it was recorded by Dick Justice, both in about 1927. Back in the 20s, it was the record industry that decided that white singers were hillbillies and black singers were blues singers. And it didn't have a whole lot to do with what kind of music was played. It was just a classification, race music for the black race and hillbilly music for the white race. And I know a lot of black singers that were really hillbillies. They wanted to sing certain songs, and the record industry told them, oh, don't do that. We got that saved for so-and-so. And my friend Pink Anderson, his whole life wanted to record My Blue Heaven, and nobody would let him.
Really? Because a black man shouldn't be performing Tin Pan Alley?
Well, it also had a lot to do with the publishing industry. They told the black man, if you come up with a, quote, original blues-type song, we'll give you $50. You want to do My Blue Heaven, you're not going to get a penny because somebody already owns the copyright on it. So the music that the scholarly audience of the 50s and 60s researched and studied so lovingly was not quite as romantic as they all considered it to be, because a lot of it was created by record industry people, as is today.
You know, I think there are a couple of traps that some white northern performers have fallen into when performing southern-based music. And I'm thinking, for instance, that some people seem to have almost lost their own voice when they sing. If they're singing black-based music, they get a completely different voice and try to sound like an older black man from the South. And I wonder if it was ever hard for you to find your own voice in your singing.
Well, I started out with very little, and it's growing. I remember when Bob Dylan's first record came out, I said, okay, I'm going to be a singer. If he can get away with that, I'm going to get away with this. And back in the early 60s, well, I moved south when I was 18 the first time I joined the Navy, ran away to sea, and moved to Virginia, and I've been headed south ever since. And I've been lucky to have been associated with some great masters of the industry. Some of them knew they were masters and others didn't.
Well, you spent some time trying to track down one of the musicians who you like most, Pink Anderson. Yeah. And he's someone that probably a lot of our listeners aren't familiar with. Tell us a little bit about him, and then
sure.
I'll ask you to do a song by him.
Pink Anderson was from Spartanburg, South Carolina. He made two records in 1929. That was that. He disappeared from the recording industry. And he spent his entire career working medicine shows, little carnival deals throughout the South. He worked with Chief Thundercloud's medicine show up until about 1959. When I met him, he was retired, had a heart attack, and didn't tour at all. He was almost discovered for the folk revival. Sam Chartist recorded a few albums, but he was past his prime, and his health didn't get better, so he stayed, and people like John Hurt and Booker White and Son House came up from the Deep South to play the big festivals. And when I met Pink, he was not in great shape. But me and my friend Paul Jeremiah started to visit him. And, at one point we realized the worst thing about his health was he was starving to death down there. And he started to play again. And we took him out on tour once before he died. And it was quite a deal. Pink Anderson's music, he was a carnival performer. And his songs were white, black, and blue. You know, they were mixed up. The song that I'm going to do next, Traveling Man, has become my theme song, and it's a song that everybody in the folk field always identified with Pink Anderson, knowing that he probably didn't write it. But it's a song that goes back to minstrel shows, and it was probably a song written by a white man on Broadway. Like so many times you get a song from a New York writer on Broadway, what was Tin Pan Alley, and it filters down to the rural community, and then it's found by some folklorist as a what a find. It happened throughout the history of country music and blues. I mean, Hank Williams' greatest hit, if you ask any country singer, it was probably the Lovesick Blues, and that was a song based on the yodel of Emmett Miller, who first recorded it in 1926. I mean, Hank Williams obviously learned it from that source. And Emmett Miller, who was a white man who sang in blackface in minstrel shows, toured the South in the early 1900s, say between 1915 and 1925. Every country singer, any country boy growing up would have seen a tent show with a minstrel man in there doing a parody of blues. And a lot of what we later listened to was actually a parody of the blues. And the song Lovesick Blues was written by two Russian immigrants in 1916, I believe, on Broadway.
A pretty twisted history.
Yeah.
Can you do a song for us from
sure
Pink Anderson?
Can. This is the old traveling man song. It came a long way.
Well, I just want to tell you about a man named Boone. His home was down in Tennessee. He made his living, he was stealing chickens and anything that he could see. That pop-eyed man, they said he runs so fast that his feet never stayed in a row. When a freight train passed, didn't matter how fast, he'd always get on board. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man that ever was in that land. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. But he didn't get caught and he never got whooped till the police shot him. You know that the police shot that man with a rifle? The bullet went through his head. People, they were coming from miles around just to see if that boy was dead. They telegrammed down south where his mama lived and she was all upset with tears. She walked up and opened up the coffin's lid, but that fool had disappeared. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man ever in that land. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. Didn't get caught in and never got whooped till the police shot him down. You know, this boy went down to the spring one day to get himself a pail of water. The distance that the rascal had to go was about 2 miles and a quarter. He got there and got his water and he started back, stumbled and fell down. He ran back to the house, got himself another bucket, caught the water before it touched the ground. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man ever in that. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. He didn't get caught and he never got whooped till the police shot him down. Now listen, this boy was out on a Titanic ship the day it was sinking down. He was standing out by the railing, had his head hung down. When that boy jumped overboard, everybody said he was a fool. But about 2 minutes right after that, well, he was shooting dice in Liverpool. He was a traveling man, certainly was a traveling man. He was the most travelingest man ever in that land. Traveled everywhere, known for many miles around. But he didn't get caught and he never got whooped until the police shot him down. Oh, Picket Roy. Caught the traveling man at last, then they had him up to hang one day. The jurymen, they all asked that man, just what did he have to say? He begged the jurymen if they would bow their heads in prayer. And then he crossed one leg and he winked one eye and he went up through the air. He was a traveling man.
Pink Anderson teach you that one?
Well, he didn't directly teach it to me, but I watched him play it.
Right.
He actually played it in a different key.
Was he surprised to see you tracking him down, wanting to learn his songs? If he'd only recorded 2 songs, he must have been pretty obscure in musical terms.
Oh, he went nuts when I went down there. I was sitting on his front porch. That's a long story. I don't have time to tell you the whole thing. But he came down the street, and I walked up the street towards him. I was playing the guitar on his step. I looked at him, I said, "You must be Pink Anderson." He said, "How do you know that?" I said, "Lady in the house said you went to the dry cleaners this morning. This is a dead-end street, and you're carrying clothes." He said, "You been to college?" I said, "Some." He thought I was pretty smart. I told him I've been looking for him for 36 hours. He asked me if I owed him money. I said, "No, sir, I owe you money." He says, "You do? How much?" I said, $50. He says, "Give it cheers." So I give him a $50 bill. He looked at it, snapped it twice, put it in his pocket, and then he inquired how did it come to be that I had owed him this small fortune. I told him I made a record of one of his songs. He said, was it a hit? I said, you be the judge. We became real good friends. He told me before he died, he says, Roy, that's what he always called me. I said, Pink? He says, you know them old songs of mine you can almost play right? I said, yeah. He says, well, I'm giving them to you. They're yours now. You just tell people Pink Anderson born and getting ready to die in Spartanburg, South Carolina, used to pick a guitar and sing.
It must be really something when someone who has been this obscure person on a rare record actually becomes a human being because you've met them and you see how they live and who they are and what their life has been like.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. It's more incredible now when I think about it than when it happened. When it happened, it was just...
It just happened.
It just happened. There we were, and me and Pink Anderson. It's pretty funny.
I want to talk to you more about your music and about touring with Gary Davis. But first, we're going to take a short break. My guest is Roy Bookbinder, and he's going to play for us some more. We'll be back after this. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Roy Bookbinder, who is in Philadelphia along with many other musicians for this weekend's Philadelphia Folk Festival. Let's talk a little bit about Reverend Gary Davis, who you also met. And I think this was before he had become rediscovered. He had already been rediscovered?
Oh, he was semi-famous when I met him. He already was living in a little house in Jamaica, Queens.
Well, there must have been people standing online wanting to understudy him.
Well, there were a bunch of us that hung around. I went on the road with him in 65, I think it was. I was just out of the Navy. I was going to college on the GI Bill when I'd met him. And I went to his house and had a guitar lesson. And we seemed to hit it off. I told him I was ready to go on the road with him. And I quit school and went with him. And I traveled with him for about two to three years on and off. And there were a lot of interesting experiences. Reverend Davis was a great guitar player in many different styles. He knew he was about the best there was, and he really was.
What's some of the strumming or finger-picking style that you learned from him?
Well, Reverend Davis, he had a number of styles. He had his simple little style, like he did Candyman, and he did the Cocaine Blues, and he did Delia. And then he'd get a little more complex in his blues, like the Hesitation Blues. Nickel is a nickel and a dime is a dime. House full of children ain't one of them mine. It was one of his other styles. And then he had an instrumental style where he imitated the piano and played ragtime pieces, which was really fascinating to the young guitar players that came around. There was a lot of interesting things going on in there. It took a lot of time for some of us to get it, some longer than others.
Most blues musicians have many stories to tell about getting ripped off while they were on the road. And I wonder if that was any worse for Gary Davis, since he was blind and it would have been that much easier for people to take advantage of him.
Well, he was taking advantage of a lot when he was singing on the streets for many years in Harlem. He'd lose guitars and what have you. First lesson Reverend Davis taught me, we got to our first rooming house out somewhere near Chicago, and Reverend Davis was getting ready to go to bed. He says, now, Roy, you got to understand. He said, we're in a strange city and a strange house here, and I don't like the house much. I said, well, how come? He said, they're not taking care of this house. I said, well, he's a blind man. I said, how do you know that? He said, well, the doorknob's loose. I checked it on the way in. He said, when you go to sleep, the first thing you do, he says, is you take out your knife. He reached in his pocket and pulled out a knife about 12 inches long. I about had a heart attack. He says, you take your knife and you put it under your pillow. He said, then you get your pocketbook. And he reached down his long jaws and pulled out his little leather purse he kept all his money in. And he always traveled with some money. He said, you put that inside your pillowcase. He said, somebody comes for your pocketbook, you know where your knife is. You go to sleep with your hand on your knife. And he goes to sleep. Next morning, about 5:30 in the morning, Reverend Davis is screaming, good God Almighty, Lord, have mercy. That could mean anything. I said, Reverend Davis, what's the matter? I mean, I was just in dreamland. Get woken up like that. I mean, he was in his 70s, the old blind man, and he was hysterical. I said, what's the matter? He says, they done got my pocketbook. I said, oh, Lord, have mercy. And we're crawling around the room, and he's screaming, who got his pocketbook? How'd somebody get in this room? He knew that door wasn't good, and didn't you hear nobody? My heart was beating a mile a minute. I'm searching all over this room. Finally, I found his pocketbook under the bed. I says, Reverend Davis? He says, Roy? That's what he always called me. I said, I found your pocketbook. All the money's in there. Don't worry. He said, good God almighty, where was my pocketbook? I said, you got to remember something when you go on the road. He says, what's that? I said, you went to sleep real late and you were tired. And I think you put your pocketbook underneath your pillowcase and your knife inside your pillowcase. And you got it mixed up and your pocketbook fell behind your pillow onto the floor. Oh, he had a fit. Give me that pocketbook. Where's my knife? Put all this stuff away.
Well, I hope this wasn't advice that you actually needed. Has it been dangerous for you on the road?
Oh, the road is a hazardous place. I mean, I've lived 13 years in a motor home called the bus. And there's different kinds of experiences out there. I mean, I grew up in New York City. I was lucky to escape, actually. But there's a different, there's a whole new world once you cross that GW bridge. I mean, we spent a lot of time in places that when I grew up, the kind of places my mother told me not to go to. And anything can happen and usually does.
Well, I guess you've had to learn how to be not only independent, but physically take care of yourself on the road?
Well, you got to.
Can you play us a song that you learned from Reverend Gary Davis?
Yeah. Let me play a song that I wrote in the style of Reverend Gary Davis.
Great.
It was a song he always did called I'll Be All Right Someday, and I loved that song. I always wanted to learn how to play it. I finally figured out the basics of it and came out with a little arrangement. And I decided I didn't feel comfortable singing the words that he'd wrote for it. It was one of these biblical epics. He had some that went on for 15 minutes, you know. And we came out with this. It's called I'm Going Home Someday. If my road is rocky and my journey's rough, if I stumble and I fall, I'll pick myself up, keep marching forward, and I'll drive these blues away. I've been a gambling man, I've been a cheat, I've often lost my way. I've seen the darkness, want to see the light, trying to start a brand new day. Yes, I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going home someday. Temptation cast aside, won't take no devil ride, I'm going home someday. Wind is blowing hard, rain is coming down, and I can't keep myself warm. But I'll keep searching for better days and a sheltered port from the storm. I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going home someday. Temptations cast aside, won't take no devil ride, I'm going home someday. Going to see my mother, going to see my father, going to see my baby brother too. And when I get there, I won't have to worry, I'll know just what to do. I'm going home, I'm going home, I'm going home, I say. Temptation cast aside, won't take no devil ride, I'm going home someday.
Great song.
Thank you.
You've been, speaking of another kind of home, you've been touring around for a long time living in your motor home, but you're trying to be based more and more in the South. You're performing a lot on a Nashville cable show. You live out of Tampa, Florida a few months a year, I believe. Where do you see yourself fitting in now in the Nashville music scene? I know you want to record there in the fall.
Right.
And you're performing with on a show that I suppose is trying to be, in a way, something like the Grand Ole Opry. Where do you see yourself fitting in to that?
Well, the Nashville Network is a showcase for country talent mostly, though they have all kinds of music. And I tried to get on there for a couple of years. We sent tapes, and all kinds of important people sent word that they were missing something. I finally got the call to do it, and it was just it was a great opportunity for me. And after the first show, the producer asked me where I'd been all these years. I said, my stuff's been on your desk. And we're on there every 8 weeks now, at least.
Is that really different than the folk scene that you've been doing for years? For years, you've been performing folk clubs, yeah. College coffee houses.
Sure.
And you're exposed to a really different kind of listener now, I think.
Right. Well, I think the goal of any artist is to reach as many people as possible, and don't pigeonhole yourself into playing just to a quote, sophisticated, knowledgeable audience. I mean, the first time I played on the Nashville Now show, we got fan mail from all over the country. I got a letter from an old man in Ohio somewhere, said he first heard this mountain style of guitar playing in 1916, and he hadn't heard it for many years. He said, you just keep doing what you're doing. You're real good at it. Don't let Nashville change you. And there's a tradition of, the Grand Ole Opry. I've been told that I will perform on the Opry this year, and what a thrill, I tell you.
That's great. Let me ask you, when you're in a city, as you are today, where do you park your motor home?
Well, we're out of town there at the Valley Forge place, and we're lucky enough to have somebody drive us in. Though I've parked it in every major city except Manhattan.
Do you just park on the street somewhere?
Yeah, I just take 3 meters and get a lot of quarters.
Gosh. Do you lock your doors very carefully?
When
I think of city life, and it just seems very vulnerable to me being parked out on the street.
I'll leave somebody in there with a shotgun.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, see, people up north laugh.
Yeah, that's what you want us to believe. we're almost out of time, and there's so much that I want,
about playing the Nashville scene and everything. It's an incredible thing to play at a state fair in rural Virginia or someplace and have people come up to you that would have never gone to a folk festival, would have never gone to a folk club, and would never have listened to a folk show.
So you think it's a self-limiting audience when you do the folk scene?
Definitely.
Does this mean you don't want to be in the folk scene anymore?
I'll always be part of this. I mean, it's part of the the whole thing. It's you got to include everything. I mean, I feel just as comfortable being here as playing the old Gaslight Cafe on McDougal Street or playing at some little nightclub in Biloxi, Mississippi.
Well, thanks for playing for us today, and I really want to thank you for visiting with us on Fresh Air. My guest has been guitarist and singer Roy Bookbinder, and he's currently in Philadelphia for the Philadelphia Folk Festival, which is about to begin. You can also catch him on the Nashville Network's cable TV show Nashville Now. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Jihan Sadat, the widow of the late President Anwar Sadat. She's written a new book about women in Egypt. So I hope you can join us. Roy, can you play us up to the end of the show?
Why, certainly.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz saxophonist Frank Morgan tells how he managed to keep his music alive during his close to 30 years in prison on drug-related charges. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the latest album from the Washington-based go-go group Trouble Funk. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews The Big Easy, starring Dennis Quaid as a New Orleans cop and Ellen Barkin as the play-it-by-the-book district attorney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of a new album from the Washington, D.C.-based go-go group Trouble Funk. Ken thinks their album Trouble Over Here, Trouble Over There could be the ticket go-go needs to reach a wider audience.
About 2 years ago, the hottest trend in popular music was something called go-go. What was go-go? It was a variation on black funk music that came out of Washington, D.C. It was as much a social phenomenon as a musical one. A whole bunch of different bands started playing dense polyrhythms on a variety of percussion instruments. The guitarists favored the sort of scratchy style that used to characterize James Brown records in the 60s, and the lyrics were little more than chanted phrases. Go-go was dance music, concert music. Compositions went on for 15, 20, even 30 minutes at a time. One song led into the next, the rhythm surging on and on until dancers drifted off the floor exhausted. To a skeptical outsider, it was possible to go to a go-go concert by bands like Trouble Funk or Chuck Brown and the Soul Searchers and come away thinking the band did nothing more than play the same song over and over for hours at a stretch. To a devoted insider, it was possible to think you'd had the time of your life every time you went to a go-go show. Here's a sample of go-go music from Trouble Funk. It's from a new album called Trouble Over Here, Trouble Over There. It's go-go slicked back and tightened up for mass consumption, but it's good go-go nonetheless. The song is called Hey T-Bone.
T-Bone!
Rock the T-Bone. type. You see, it's uncut, raw, original, you see. Hoppin', bumpin', not fancy. It's go-go, Latin, a little African jazz. I got a dip-bop beat with a lot of pizzazz. That's the ticket to a fun-filled night. My congo beat will make you bump. That's right, like this.
Like what?
It's like this.
Hey, Tebow!
The Washington band Trouble Funk from its new album Trouble Over Here, Trouble Over There. At its peak, Go-Go made a big media splash. Go-Go was intriguing because it was an example of something that's increasingly rare, a truly regional music nurtured by a small community of musicians that has very little to do with what's popular on the radio. On top of everything else, this regional music was emanating from Washington, a town the media knows for its political life, not its musical one. So newspapers and magazines from all over the country did Go-Go stories, and, sure sign of a pop fad, an exploitation film was made about the music. Entitled Good to Go, the movie starred Art Garfunkel, of all people, and was a dismal failure on every level. Go-Go quickly faded from mass media consciousness. Some say that media hype killed Go-Go, that the music was never given time to evolve and nurture its own knowledgeable audience, but chances are Go-Go will never take the record charts by storm. In the context of these conservative pop times, this music is just too radical in its notions of sprawling song structure and minimalist verbal sentiments. If it carves out any commercial space at all, Go-Go will probably be like reggae, a cult music with a small but devoted following. This new Trouble Funk album is a strong record, the best solution yet to the problem of converting a concert music into recorded music. It suggests that with persistence, Go-Go has the potential to be more than just a passing fad.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He reviewed Trouble Over Here, Trouble Over There, the new album by Trouble Funk.
Tomorrow is gonna be different. We're gonna raise a little hell until we get it together. God bless the children.
This is Fresh Air. The jazz world is welcoming the re-emergence of a musician who had been absent from the scene for so long, many of his fans thought he was dead. For 30 years, alto saxophonist Frank Morgan was in and out of California prisons on charges related to a heroin habit, supported by forging checks and fencing stolen property. Morgan's out, he says he's kicked his habit, and he's started a new life. His parole was recently lifted, allowing him to take his first European tour from which he just returned. He's also just finished his third album since his release from prison. When Frank Morgan walked away from prison for the last time in 1985, he left with his playing intact, having performed in prison bands for inmates and visitors. He told me that jazz musicians in prison were given a special status.
In a sense, in a small sense, I was like a superstar in prison. People, you know, everyone in the prison knew my name. Everyone mostly came to hear, you know, us when we played, even though they weren't, everyone wasn't jazz fans, it was, but it's like the only game in town, you know. For a person to go back time after time, like I did, when I could have stayed on the streets and played music and maybe got a chance to see the world, I think that there was a connection that, to me, having found a comfortable place in prison, where I was like a superstar, when on the streets I was just a small fish in a big pond. In prison, I was a big fish in a small pond.
You spent time in several different prisons. Were you always able to keep your saxophone?
No, there were times when I didn't have it, but most of the time I did. Most of the time it was made convenient. The prison authorities felt that good music helped to keep the prisoners peaceful, and we were used very much in that respect. You know, there were times when the staff would ask us to put on a concert out in the yard if they felt there was a lot of tension, and it was effective. But that's enough of that. You know, someone else can do that now.
Well, it must have been a pretty interesting music scene in prison, especially in California prisons, because there was, starting in the 50s, there was really a thriving West Coast jazz scene. And unfortunately, many of the musicians ended up with habits like you did and ended up in prison. Were there a lot of terrific musicians you got to play with while you were incarcerated?
Sure. Not a lot. You know, there wasn't always a great number of good musicians there. But over a period of time, there were a lot of fine musicians that I was in custody with. And sometimes it was as good a band as you could, you know, you'd want to play with on the streets. I mean, in a small, maybe there was enough guys to make up a sextet. Fine players, you know.
Could you practice anytime you wanted to, or were there rules about that?
Sure, there were rules. We couldn't practice in the middle of the night or anything like that, but generally I could practice from any time from 7:30 in the morning until 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening, and then we would go to our cells to be counted and to have dinner, and then come back out at 6:30 and stay out until about 10 o'clock. So, we were able to get a good day's music in.
On the outside, jazz has become less of a popular music than it used to be, and it's really funk and rock that are getting played mostly on the radio and that sell the most records and get the most people coming for concerts. And I wonder if a similar thing happened in jail, if jazz became less popular in jail like it did in the outside world.
Well, yes, it did. I think that one of the things that contributed to me deciding to stay out of prison was they're no longer the musicians that play the kind of music that I appreciate. Most of them have gotten smart and are either died or have gotten smart and changed their lifestyle. So I guess the handwriting on the wall was that I no longer needed to be there if I couldn't even play the music.
So it's like a musical generation gap in prison for you.
Yeah, there's a whole different set of things happening that I no longer feel that I can relate to. The prisons and the people have become more violent. And being a nonviolent person, I don't need to be there. I mean, it's bad enough being in a free society with all the violence going on, but I think I need to be where I have some other options, you know.
The last time you got out, in 1985,
yes.
You must have really felt like you were on display, because everybody was watching you. Everyone wanted to hear how you sounded, and also people wanted to see if you could stay straight or not. I mean, I think, let's face it, when a really well-respected musician who had a habit gets out of jail, people want to know, can he make it this time? Was that a lot of pressure for you to be under, being musically tested and almost drug-tested at the same time?
Oh, yes. It's still a pressure situation, but isn't life itself, a pressure situation? It's certainly no more pressure than I had upon me trying to get together $1,500 a day, you know, to supply, you know, to buy the dope that I felt that I needed. You know, there I have a set of problems now that are entirely different from the ones I had before. As an example, I mean, you know, now I have to maybe decide which agent to sign with, or which record company to, you know, to enter into an agreement with. I like these problems a lot better, you know.
When you get out of prison on drug-related charges, are there people who hang around and try to tempt you back onto drugs? People who figure that you're vulnerable and they could make some money off of you?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, I was a very good customer. I mean, I spent a lot of money. I didn't really cause a dealer a lot of problems. If I went to someone's house, I tried to be respectful of their family or, you know, or whatever their situations was. Sure, so people don't want to really give that up. But God willing, that's not going to happen. I've spent, you know, enough money sending some dope dealers' kids to college, and I'm not sorry for it. I enjoyed what I did. I did it with gusto, you know, if you will. I did it until I completely got tired of it, and that's enough.
I think there's a real intensity in your playing now, and it makes me think about all the years you were in prison when probably one of the few real pleasures you had, maybe I'm wrong, was playing, because your freedom was taken away, but your instrument wasn't, and you could still play. And maybe that kept a certain intensity to your playing.
I certainly acknowledge the fact that in prison, the instrument was the thing that kept me sane, if you will. And the chance to play it, you know, kept me with hope. And now I have a chance to play it and to play it with fine musicians and go home, you know, after I play it and have a nice home to go to, you know, with a nice piano and a beautiful partner to share life with. And I really, I think that the intensity is just really starting, you know, because I really intend to play and to play my heart out.
Frank Morgan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Frank Morgan's new album, Bebop Lives, is on the Fantasy record label. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What stories are coming up today?
Terry, today we'll have a report out of South Africa on the strike that continues there. More black mine workers have been fired. Also, a report from Korea on the role of Catholic and Protestant religious leaders in the political activism there. Also, I'll be speaking with our congressional correspondent, Linda Wertheimer, on why, given so many others are running, a number of high-profile politicians have chosen to stay out or get out of the race for the presidency. Yesterday, Paul Laxalt took himself out of the running. He cited a lack of funds. Today, Sam Nunn said he won't be running.
Thank you, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Jim McBride's new movie, The Big Easy, stars Ellen Barkin and Dennis Quaid. It's a story set in New Orleans about cops and corruption. With the chemistry between Quaid and Barkin, Cajun cooking isn't the only thing that's hot in this movie. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review.
This month in theaters all over America, you'll be seeing the same scene played out over and over again. I mean in the audience, not on the screen. Wherever The Big Easy is showing, female moviegoers will be watching Dennis Quaid make love to Ellen Barkin, and they'll turn to the man sitting at their side, and they'll sigh. Deeply. I'll tell you what that sigh means. It means, why can't you be Dennis Quaid? Just for a day, a night, an hour. It also means a star is busy being born. The Big Easy is a raffish cop film with a dumb screenplay and a beguiling loosey-goosey atmosphere. It's good fun, and Dennis Quaid walks off with it. Quaid is fast and brainy on screen, but he also has this charmingly facetious languor. Even describing a gore-spattered murder victim, he can't help sweet-talking. You may remember him as the man who got miniaturized earlier this summer in Inner Space, but that was Martin Short's movie. The Big Easy belongs to Quaid. He plays Remy, a smart New Orleans police lieutenant who's just a little bit on the take. Ellen Barkin is the assistant DA who's come to New Orleans to investigate police lieutenants who are a little bit on the take. She's a starchy, by-the-book type, and Quaid immediately sets about getting her to let her hair down at the best Cajun restaurant in town.
We've got Cajun couscous and we've got no basque.
No, nothing for me, thanks. I have to be up very early tomorrow.
Yeah, I guess we're just going to take the check tonight, Paul.
What you talking about, Chef?
I mean, I want the check, Paul.
Remy done lost his mind. He knows his money no good in here.
Then why don't you just give me the check?
Paul, have you met Ann Osborne with the district attorney's office?
Oh, really? You looking for that check, Remy? Right here it is all the time.
Ellen Barkin is best at playing smart, naughty girls, and she seems a little uncomfortable in a role that's basically patterned on all those plain librarians who become suddenly sultry upon the removal of their eyewear. But once she warms up, the movie's a lot of fun. The director, Jim McBride, has trouble with some of the action scenes, and the ending he's cooked up is almost unforgivably lame. But he makes the movie feel as easy as its title suggests. There's room in it for a lot of loose-shouldered joking around, for a lot of good-time music and wacko performing. The late Charles Ludlam is especially funny, camping it up as a Southern shyster lawyer. And though The Big Easy isn't full of nudity or raunch, it does feature the sexiest sex scene since Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie leaped into the fray in Don't Look Now. These scenes are sexy because Quaid and Barkin really seem to be discovering each other, and themselves, as we watch. Which is why this month, in theaters all over the country, I'm afraid the size may be deafening.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. He reviewed The Big Easy. Here's a preview of the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Steve Lacy, the jazz musician who brought the soprano saxophone into a modern setting. Singer Jane Voss and pianist Hoyle Osborne will be back to perform an original song, and humorist Al Gingold will describe how reorganizing his record collection shook up his marriage. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.